From Warren to Winbur, Breezewood to Smithport, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Paul J. McNulty is now president of Grove City College, but he served as the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia and was a leader in our nation's response to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. He joins us for a look back at events of that fateful day. Halfway through the fiscal year, counties across the state are taking stock of their finances. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report on how Allegheny County is doing. And under the guise of infrastructure, Congress is considering a massive expansion of federal intrusion into the healthcare sector. Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity talks about it on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Paul J. McNulty of Grove City College in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. An obscure regulatory board known as the Independent Regulatory Review Commission has given final approval to the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI, which would embroil Pennsylvania in a multi-state compact supposedly to lower CO2 emissions, but which opponents point out would be a death knell for coal-fired power plants, throwing thousands out of work, and would also result in higher consumer electric bills. REGI is essentially a carbon tax, and state lawmakers immediately took steps to disapprove the regulations, which they say cannot be implemented without legislative action. According to the Center Square, Republicans are moving forward with a concurrent resolution opposing the regulations, setting up a showdown with Democratic Governor Tom Wolf, who is determined to implement REGI through the regulatory rather than the legislative process. A new nationwide poll conducted by the Club for Growth shows growing support for more parental choices in K-12 education. Club for Growth President David McIntosh said, quote, "Because of the pandemic and the over-politicization of classrooms across the country, more and more parents are demanding a say in schooling." The poll findings suggest the term school choice should be rebranded as school freedom, because opponents of parental rights have for decades attacked and spread misinformation on the term school choice. Public opinion has shifted in favor of school choice, a trend which has accelerated as the COVID-19 pandemic persists. Complete poll results can be found at clubforgrowth.org. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. It has been 20 years since terrorists flew planes into the Twin Towers at the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and heroes foiled yet another attack by crashing a plane into a field in Somerset County. Paul J. McNulty now serves as president of Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, but during his tenure as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, he prosecuted key players in planning those attacks. Paul, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Paul, you played a very integral role in what occurred in the days after September 11th, 2001. But I would first of all be interested in hearing your remembrances of that day and also remind our listeners what took place and the seriousness of the event.
That morning, I was at the Department of Justice. I was a senior Department of Justice official. President Bush had nominated me to become the U.S. Attorney in Eastern Virginia, where eventually the terrorist cases would be sent for prosecution. At that time, while I was awaiting confirmation, I was serving with Attorney General Ashcroft as a senior advisor. I had been responsible for the transition of the Department of Justice from the Clinton administration to the new administration and had worked closely with him for those first 9 months. And so the morning of the attack, I came to the Department of Justice for what I thought would be a normal Tuesday morning. It was a beautiful day in Washington, D.C. area, as it was in all of the Northeast. And I had actually just dropped off two of my children at their school. And as I was parking my car at the DOJ garage, the first plane hit the World Trade Center number one. And it was reported first instance as bizarre, unusual accident, tragedy that occurred. And while I thought that was very interesting, got out of my car, went into the Department of Justice. And by the time I reached the suite of offices, I shared with the Deputy Attorney General, Larry Thompson, the second plane hit the World Trade Center Tower 2. And so together, he and I recognized that America was under attack. Attorney General Ashcroft was actually in Milwaukee at that point, as were other cabinet members who were doing school-related presentations on that Tuesday. It was a kind of education week, and we remember the famous scene of President Bush being down in Tampa in a classroom when he learned about all of this. So we immediately had to jump into action. We had to evacuate the Department of Justice building. We had to locate ourselves to a command center to begin to coordinate the Department of Justice and FBI response to the entire attack. And it was at the Department of Justice Command Center where I watched on the big screen TVs that we have in this sort of high-tech room, the crumbling towers. It's also where we realized that Flight 93 had crashed into the Pennsylvania field. And so some of the things that were most memorable unfolded as we were watching them in that command center. And then the rest of the day for us at DOJ was really about beginning a criminal investigation and trying to find out whether or not there were any other attacks underway, which was a interesting and a difficult process in itself.
You referenced in your answer, Paul, that you ended up prosecuting some of the terrorists as the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. Tell us a little bit about that experience, who you prosecuted, and how you even began to go about conducting that sort of an investigation and prosecution, because I can't imagine that there was a lot of precedent for this.
That's for sure. I mean, there had been some terrorist attacks, and there was the World Trade Center bombing of 1993, which incidentally had been inspirational to terrorists as they were thinking about trying to hit America on its own turf again. But Zakarias Messaoui was an Al-Qaeda member. He was someone who had, like the other 19 hijackers, become radicalized in different places, and then an educated person who then sought to be a loyal member of Al-Qaeda and loyal to bin Laden. And he was sent to the United States to get training to fly an airplane. So he took instructions in flight, but particularly in Minnesota, to learn how to fly, or to actually not even learn to take off, not really learn to land, but just learn to fly, which was alarming to the instructor. But on a simulator up in Minnesota, this was happening in August, a month before the attacks. And it was the alarming nature of his instruction, where he didn't even yet fly, knew how to fly a small plane, but he was learning how to command a 757. And that alerted the flight instructor to call the FBI. He was subsequently arrested and then held on an immigration charge. And so on the day of the attack, Zakarias Messaoui is sitting in a jail cell in Minnesota. And he was supposed to be, if they could have pulled it off, piloting a fifth plane, which most likely would have gone to the White House, since we think Flight 93, which crashed in Pennsylvania, was going to the Capitol. So as we began to understand what happened on the day of September 11th, the FBI quickly realized that the person sitting in a jail in Minnesota was connected to all of this. And day by day, we saw those connections just become clearer and clearer. He was moved from Minnesota to New York City to be a material witness for the initial investigation. But then the decision was made he could be indicted as a co-conspirator, since he knew what was going on and had been part of the larger plan cooked up by Al-Qaeda chiefs, particularly Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for responsibility for the entire attack as a co-conspirator. And then it was decided that that case should be brought in Eastern Virginia for a number of reasons. And so he was moved to Alexandria, Virginia in December of 2001, and we indicted him. And we also sought the death penalty against him. And so at that point, our case involved everything about 9/11. And we had a very large team of FBI agents and victim witness outreach coordinator types and a team of prosecutors. I think at times when we looked at the people who also were working on just document controls, we had nearly 100 individuals working on the investigation. And the case actually took 4.5 years because we were seeking the death penalty. He was fighting us on that punishment, but taking responsibility, actually admitting to his role in the overall conspiracy. And so what we really ended up doing was presenting a case to the jury for a decision to execute Zacharias Moussaoui, but not to hold him guilty since he pled guilty to the charges in the indictment.
We are talking with Paul J. McNulty, who is president of Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. Also, as we've been discussing, he was the U.S. attorney who prosecuted a number of those who participated in the attacks of September 11th, 2001. And Paul, one of the things we want to do is we now are observing the 20th, commemorating the 20th anniversary of these attacks, is to remember the victims. Talk a bit about the victims and how we can honor their memory, why we should honor their memory.
It's such an important factor in all of this because we will spend time at the 9/11 anniversary to remember what happened. But we really have to honor these individuals who, in a sense, died for all of us. If you look at the fatwa that was declared by bin Laden in 98, he basically said to all of his followers, to every Muslim, that was the audience that he was addressing, he said, your duty is to kill Americans everywhere, anywhere. And so, and he said civilian or military. And so he was declaring war against the United States and declaring war against all Americans. Now, thankfully, only a tiny number of individuals, extremist terrorists, followed his declaration. But they were out to get any of us, all of us. And so that day, those nearly 3,000 people who died essentially took the bullet for the entire country. They were the people who were going about their business. The stories are so moving. You know, there was just one personal tragic moment after another. I think about, for example, on Flight 77, the one that went into the Pentagon. You had some junior high age science students from schools in D.C., who, along with their teachers, were flying to California for a kind of once-in-a-lifetime science trip. And you can imagine the excitement that they had for what they were going to be able to learn and see and experience. You had so many young parents. You had victims, family members who were expecting mothers and so forth. All these people went off to work that day or went off to fly those planes with just a routine day in mind. And that's why terrorism is so evil, because they are aiming at that kind of normalcy that we cherish. The terrorists thought of themselves as courageous heroes going into battle, and the exact opposite is true. They were cowards attacking innocent people, and it's so important for us to know their stories, some of their stories at least, and give them the reverence that they deserve.
So where does all this leave us now, Paul? We had the spectacle of what occurred in Afghanistan over the last couple of weeks, the Taliban now back completely in control of that country. Do we still have the resolve to continue fighting this war on terror? Because it sure seems like the terrorists do.
Yeah, we will find out where we stand as some things begin to evolve in Afghanistan as just one piece of this larger story. Because bin Laden had sanctuary there from the Taliban. Make no mistake about it. I mean, he was operating freely in Afghanistan, training terrorists, conducting his operations from that safe haven. That's why we went there. And so do we think the Taliban would provide sanctuary to others who want to attack America? And how would we prevent that from happening? We have to remember horrors of the day. It seemed to me that too many politicians wanted to move past it too quickly. And when I served as U.S. attorney and then later as deputy attorney general, there were times where I just wanted to say, have you flown into New York City lately? Have you looked out your window? And have you seen that there are no Twin Towers? And has that had the impact on you that it should? That the notion that those Twin Towers were brought down in the way they were and the agony that was suffered as a result, these are things that we just have to recite and then resolve that we are going to stay on top of it. Now, I want to give credit where credit is due because a lot has been accomplished in terms of making airplanes so much safer than they were in 2001. These terrorists went through metal detectors, they had knives and box cutters and so forth, and they got through with those and dramatically changed the way in which we make people safe to travel, and we deserve to feel good about that. And so it's a question of what are the other vulnerabilities? How committed are we to making sure that we are paying attention to whatever signals might come our way?
Remembering the events of September 11th, 2001, with Paul J. McNulty, the president of Grove City College. Paul, thank you again for taking time to be with us.
Loman, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Allegheny County, like counties across the state, is halfway through its fiscal year, and officials are assessing how well they're doing financially. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have crunched those numbers and have this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm your host, Frank Gamrat, and with me today is Allegheny Institute Research Director Eric Montardi. You had a recent policy brief, which you can get off our website at AlleghenyInstitute.org, looking at Allegheny County's finances through June, that is, expenditures and revenues. Can you give our listeners a summary of what you found?
So in the first 6 months, looking at Allegheny County's revenues, they've raised $631.7 million, which is 69% of their 2021 budget. The county, just like many other counties across the state, their revenue comes from a combination of taxes and then what we call non-taxes. That'd be money from licenses, permits, fines, monies from other government, especially state government. There's a lot of money that passes through to Allegheny County for the health and human services function that it carries out. And that's where the county stands at the end of the second quarter, January through June. Through those same 6 months, the county spent $447.8 million. That's about 47% of its budget. And again, the county's functions, health and human services, courts, administrative services, public works, public safety, the jail, a bunch of other functions that are carried out by the county. Some of them, there's some overlaps with the municipalities in the county, but then there's things that the county does exclusively. So again, that's about 47% of its budget that's been spent to date. And when to look a little bit closer at the taxes, specifically because we know last year with coronavirus, with things being shut down, with things being affected, we've tried to keep really good track of what's gone on with the monthly finances for the county. Basically, the county itself collects six main taxes. Its biggest revenue source, tax or non-tax, however you count it, is the real estate tax. And that raised $366.9 million. And the county bills its taxes in February. Typically, it has a period where you pay early, you get a discount, then it goes to face, then it goes to delinquent. Well, in the last 2 years, because of the coronavirus, the county council has opted to move the deadline back. This year, it was June 1st, but they've collected $282 million of that total in April. And right now, that's about 95% of what they've budgeted for this year. The county also levies a sales tax. It gets one quarter of that money, and they've raised just about $28 million. A little bit over half of what they budgeted. Then there's a few excise taxes that the county has. There's a hotel tax, there's a vehicle rental tax, and there's an alcoholic beverage tax. Now, again, as we mentioned, because of last year, things being shut down, travel restricted, people not going out to eat, people not going out to bars, those taxes were affected significantly, especially April, May, and June of last year. Now, this year, hotel tax, and the county gets just a very small portion of it because a lot of it goes to debt service and for other tourism functions. It's collected just about 27% of that tax this year, essentially $260,000. The vehicle tax, which is again a $2 per day tax on vehicles rented, they've collected $2.4 million of that, which is 40% or 42% of that tax. And then the alcoholic beverage tax. And it's important to note, it's not a tax on beer distributors or state stores. It's basically, again, going into a restaurant, going into a bar, going into an event where there'd be a cash bar. They've collected $13 million of that tax, and they budgeted, I believe it's $25 million this year. So again, a little bit over 50% of that tax has been collected. And then because there's a casino here, the state says that the Rivers Casino pays a host fee to Allegheny County based on the slot machine gross terminal revenues. And through June, they got $2 million of that host fee out of the $4.8 million that they budgeted. If you look on the spending side, biggest expenses there would be personnel and fringe benefits. That's $228 million, very close to 50% of budget for those two items. And then looking at the departments and just trying to figure, if we're at the midpoint of the year, the departments spent half of their budgets, more than half, less than half. Out of the 30 departments, there's three that spent at the end of June 50% or more than their budget.
Seven departments
spent less than 40%. And the rest are in somewhere in the middle, but the average overall was 42% spent of budget.
Okay, well, the obvious question here is, this is 2021. How did those figures, both revenue, mostly revenue, compare to 2019? The reason I say 19 is you really can't compare to 2020 because of, as you said, we had the virus and the lockdown and whatnot. How did it compare to our last, let's call it normal year of 2019?
Looking at those first 6 months of 2019, so January through June, if you look at property tax collections, on all these taxes, none of the rates have changed since 2019. They are at the same rates that they were 2 years ago. Property tax revenue is virtually unchanged. Mm-hmm. Collect close to 100% of what it was levied last year of that of the 2019 collections, and now it's up a little bit this year in those first 6 months. Sales taxes took a dip, but now they're back above where they were in 2019. The ones that, again, still affected, hotel, vehicle, alcohol tax, and gaming host fee, those things were down significantly last year. The three of them have come back higher than they were at the point in June of 2020 as a percentage of the 2019 collections. The only one that's still down is hotel tax. Mm-hmm. And that, again, is a 7% tax that levied on hotel stays, motel stays. Airbnb rentals were added a few years ago and subject to the tax as well. Mixed bag, I guess, at this point at the end of June in terms of those six taxes.
Mm-hmm. That's good stuff, Eric. I'd like to thank my colleague Eric for joining me today. I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like more information on this or other topics, I invite you to visit our website at AlleghenyInstitute.org. Thank you.
Congress is returning to session, and a spending spree totaling trillions of dollars is being debated. Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania gives us details on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
As Congress returns to vote on the $1.2 trillion infrastructure plan on September 27th, Speaker Pelosi's self-imposed non-binding deadline that was provided to entice members to vote in favor of the $3.5 trillion budget bill and advance the infrastructure plan back on August 24th, a vote that was made along party lines, the voice of the American taxpayer is needed now more than ever. Over the next couple of weeks, we can be the difference makers in whether this massive spending package navigates the legislative hurdles in the House and Senate to get to the president, or if it's killed before that time, an outcome we will be working to achieve. An additional successful scenario would be a compromise, which is also dependent on us to effectuate. Through concerted pressure, we could see some of the major provisions or pay-fors removed, resulting in savings of trillions of dollars for future generations while fending off massive government expansions by way of taxes, energy, regulation, or health care. If these endeavors prove unsuccessful, we could see the plan in its entirety pass, a $4.7 trillion spend that enacts incredibly damaging policies. It would hurt taxpayers, fund lawmakers' partisan pet projects, and grow the federal government's control over American health care. An argument that Americans for Prosperity President Tim Phillips and former Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal recently made in an op-ed for National Review. Senator Sanders' proposal in particular would balloon both Medicare and Medicaid to unsustainable levels and hurt coverage under these programs. From the op-ed titled, Lawmakers' Latest Infrastructure Scheme is a Takeover of American Healthcare, Sanders' plan would also expand Medicare for dental, vision, and hearing to the tune of $370 billion over 10 years, duplicating coverage and further straining the financially strapped program, like leading to care rationing and higher premiums for seniors. It also is an unnecessary expense. Medicare already offers care for certain serious dental, vision, and hearing issues, and many Medicare Advantage plans offer routine care for teeth, eyes, and ears. And of course, a multitude of private plans are available to seniors for these types of care. The plan would pressure states to expand Medicaid, a program that it is apparently very easy for lawmakers to forget is designed to help low-income Americans. But nevertheless, some in Congress want the program to cover more able-bodied adults, forcing states to either raise taxes or cut other essential programs. Phillips and Jindal conclude by urging Congress to focus on infrastructure rather than the wasteful and destructive healthcare policies in Senator Sanders' budget proposal. Lawmakers must reject this proposal, they say, but they should not focus solely on the skin-deep debate over infrastructure, because that isn't what these packages are about. Instead, lawmakers need to pay attention to what's actually going on in Senator Sanders' budget proposal and the harm it would do to healthcare outcomes. It's the issue Americans care about the most, and it is where Congress is poised to inflict the greatest damage. You know, our friends at Americans for Tax Reform put together a list of tax increases that the budget reconciliation legislation is expected to include. And while the list is over a dozen strong, we're highlighting a few of the most egregious that have been publicly floated in addition to those just mentioned. 1. Raising the corporate tax rate to 28%, a rate higher than communist China. 2. Doubling the capital gains tax to 43.4%. 3. Creating a second death tax by eliminating step-up in basis. 4. Imposing a 15% minimum tax on book income. And 5. A tax on American energy manufacturers based on their methane production. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity. You can find us on Facebook by searching at PAAFP and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 26 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WTYM-AM in Katanning, along with WNTP-AM and WFIL-AM in Lafayette Hill, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.